and welcome to the SAGE podcast of Critical Sociology's Labor Scholar Series. I'm Graham Cassano, Culture and Media Editor for Critical Sociology.
Daniel Clark is an Associate Professor of History at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. He is the author of Like Night and Day, Unionization in a Southern Mill Town. In June 2012, we spoke about his recent research, Rethinking the Detroit Auto Worker of the 1950s.
What's the dominant narrative framework often used, not always, but often used by historians to conceptualize the experience of the Detroit UAW auto worker of the 1950s?
I'd say on the whole, the dominant framework is that this was a decade of prosperity, of emerging middle-class status for auto workers. There's a sense that the gains of the 1930s were solidified and that the UAW successfully negotiated for increased wages, increased benefits. And there's a sense of loss in the dominant framework as well, since most historians who have looked at auto workers in this decade wish that things had turned out differently, that a more militant social unionism had emerged after World War II.
What aspects of this conventional picture do you think most need rethinking?
The dominant framework is drawn primarily from aggregate wage data, from the experiences of Walter Reuther and top-level UAW leaders. What I found missing was any sense of the experience of actual auto workers. I thought that maybe oral history would be a good way to try to explore these issues. And as I charted the lives of individuals who intersected with auto work in the 1950s, I realized that the whole category of auto workers was really shifting, and that many workers who aspired to be auto workers in the 1950s were only able to be auto workers for about half the decade. I realized this just from the oral history evidence that I was accumulating. And so it just opened my eyes to the possibility that actual people lived the 50s much more differently from the overarching framework.
Give us some more details about how you developed these oral histories.
I initially thought I would just be fleshing out the details of prosperity. I made some contacts with local retiree chapters, local UAW local retiree chapters, and made pitches, talked with people. And in each case, I was able to find some people at these luncheons who would take the plunge and agree to be interviewed. I adopted a life history approach to each interviewee, trying to figure out where they were born and how they proceeded through life. And what I realized after doing a few dozen of these was that in almost every case, these auto workers had experienced the decade as one of job instability and economic insecurity. I was taken aback by that the first few times I heard it, and then it became a recurring theme, recurring pattern. There's no doubt that talking with these retirees jumbled up in my mind what these workers or what it meant to be an auto worker in the 1950s, and certainly made problematic the dominant framework. And so I wondered at that point if I had just found, you know, the 40 or 45 outliers who were unable to find secure livelihoods in the auto industry in the 1950s. So I decided that I would read local newspapers. I would read the Free Press. I would read the Detroit News. I would read the Michigan Chronicle, the African American Weekly, published in Detroit. And what I found is that the newspaper research completely corroborated the findings of job insecurity or economic insecurity and job instability in the 1950s for a whole host of reasons beyond what I had encountered in the interviews. I had no idea when I started the newspaper research how much of it I would do. And I started just dabbling, you know, a month here, a month there, just to see. And it was so rich with important details and problematic evidence that I ended up reading 16 years on microfilm of the Detroit Free Press and probably about a third of that of the news and, you know, a good 11-year run of the Michigan Chronicle.
What were the causes of some of the job instability?
One thing I learned from the interviews is something that I think it would be hard to get from any other kind of source. And that's that sometimes it was a matter of things that weren't necessarily related to all auto workers at any particular point in time. But sometimes people left auto work because of family responsibilities back in Arkansas, or because a spouse wanted to try a career in a different area, or because it was your passion throughout your life to work in the printing business, or because you got drafted. The military interrupted many an auto career for men in the 1950s. Well, starting with the alleged post-war boom, right in the aftermath of World War II, the auto industry was stagnant because of material shortages. The conversion to a peacetime economy went very slowly and not in the favor of the auto industry. Steel shortages, part shortages, because of steel shortages, the auto industry really didn't come anywhere near full production until perhaps a few months before the big recession in 1949. And so layoffs were chronic, and short weeks were chronic right from the get-go after World War II. Any of these auto companies was subject to all kinds of rows of dominoes from the supply chains heading in and then back out. So if there was a strike at an auto body supplier, then the assembly line has to shut down within a day. And then every other supplier due to that assembly plant shuts down quickly. And so a strike of two people in one department, in one plant, could eventually lead to 40 or 50,000 people unemployed for a week or two in virtually no time, within a day or two. Ironically, many of the layoffs were because of militancy, either on one's own part or because of someone else. In almost all cases, they were either responding to oppressive work conditions, the effects of runaway inflation on their take-home pay, or matters of dignity, not unlike those from the 1930s. There were examples of people who supported every strike that came down the pike and assumed the best and assumed good faith and said, this is the sacrifice we have to make for the larger cause. But there were an awful lot of people in each of these instances who also thought, damn, I'm losing a day's pay. Right. I'm losing a week's pay. I can't afford to do this. I can't make my payments. I'm having my used car repossessed. There were all kinds of pieces of evidence in the paper as well of people very frustrated by the fact that they couldn't get a full week of work in for 6 months at a time. Right. I think especially for these younger workers, some of whom were coming from union backgrounds, but many of whom were not, it was all just bewildering. An increasing number of auto workers throughout the 50s had no experience of the 1930s. The Korean War was devastating to the Detroit auto industry. They tried a guns and butter approach, but almost all the gun contracts went to plants outside of Detroit. They were mostly big three plants, but just not ones in the Detroit area. And then, of course, Cold War planners thought that there might be a World War III in the works, and so they were commandeering supplies. And so the supply shortages, material shortages, that the auto industry experienced after World War II became exaggerated during the Korean War. And so unemployment in 1951 and 52 in Detroit was enormous. But there had been tens of thousands of people flocking to Detroit, hoping that it would become the arsenal of democracy again. As soon as the Korean War was over, there was a certain upsurge in auto production. And so I think if you were to say that there was a time when anyone could just go down and get a job in the auto industry, that would have been maybe 3 months in 1950, a couple months in 1953, maybe the first half of 1955. But in each of those cases, these people would have been laid off en masse the following year because there was a huge recession in 1954. Unemployment benefits would kick in after a week, but you might make $20 a week, $24 a week when if you were working full-time, you'd be pulling home $60, $70, $80 a week. Housing was also scarce and expensive for whites, worse for blacks. There's no doubt about it. But it was also very difficult for whites, and especially whites who had children. It was almost impossible to find a rental unit if you had kids.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. And remember, this is the baby boom era.
Yep.
Okay. And a lot of families coming up from the South would have 6, 7, 8 kids. Inflation was a serious problem, and it was worse in Detroit than in many other markets around the country. It's a legacy of the lack of housing construction in the 1930s and during World War II, and then the huge influx of population. So what I was finding is that if you just read the statistics on the surface, these were boom years for the auto industry, but the prosperity was not trickling down. It wasn't experienced by ordinary auto workers who were experiencing much more turbulent working condition or access to livelihoods. It was unsteady for sure. On the other hand, middle managers, engineers, the middle class was supported largely by auto workers' efforts. They sailed through, for the most part, pretty easily. I remember one time a Free Press reporter couldn't believe that working class Detroiters were actually hurting because sales were holding steady at Hudson's, the rather elite department store. But he toured around in working class areas and found that furniture stores were going bankrupt there. And what I found is that it was possible for there to be record earnings, record wages on paper. Okay, and if you just multiplied out what workers were supposed to be getting on a 5 or 6 day a week basis with overtime, as the paper always did, right. and multiplied out, then they're making lots of money. But in reality, we're talking about huge bouts of unemployment, layoffs, erratic income, and anyone who bought a dining room set, bought a television, bought a car. In this period was playing with fire because you never could be certain you'd make those payments.
Right.
And it was very clear from all the sources that auto workers were not in the market for new cars. It was impossible for auto workers to buy new cars unless they had some kind of luck.
How would you modify the dominant narrative about the 1950s?
The dominant framework with respect to auto workers, it's held in among labor historians primarily because it supposedly is a period when choices could have been made that could have headed both the union and the nation in a different direction, a better direction, a direction that we'd like to see come to fruition. A much stronger social safety network, national health care for sure, stronger pensions, more workplace democracy, these sorts of things. And so I think that to some extent labor historians are assuming, because of the alleged prosperity, that it was a world of unlimited choices and leaders just made the wrong ones. If we understand that that these workers were scrambling just to eat and keep roofs over their heads, clothe their kids. Almost each of these workers at some point or other had their butt saved by the UAW with some kind of grievance or something that kept them in their position. But most of these workers were only dimly aware of the existence of the UAW beyond that during the 1950s because they were only auto workers about half the decade, scrambling entirely. Not a single one said that it was an easy decade. Not a single one said it was a decade where they were living well and enjoying the good life or anything along those lines at all. And so I think that the framework has to be altered so that we realize that this was a period of confusion, of fear in many cases. In the 50s, it turns out, in my view of things right now, that the union movement was still aspirational as opposed to having actually reached the promised land. There was an interesting article in the Free Press about the 10,000th Ford retiree. Okay, Ford was proud of its retirement plan. They fought it, mind you. Okay, but when they had the pension plan in place, then suddenly, oh, this is what we do for our workers. And so they called the press, television stations, to come on down to the house of the 10,000th retiree and help them celebrate. And so they stuck the microphones in front of him and brought him out of the house and said, "What are you going to do now that you're retired?" And he said, "I can't afford to retire. I have to keep working. I'm just not going to work at Ford. I haven't been able to repair the house in 20 years. The roof is leaking. The walls are falling in." He said, "I haven't been able to save a penny, the last 20 years." And this guy had a solid job. And you could just see all these reporters, kind of tucking tail and heading back out. And, Ford never tried this publicity stunt again.
Thank you, Professor Daniel Clark.
Thanks to Roz Hartigan for engineering and production. This podcast series was made possible in part through a grant from Wayne State University. I'm Graham Cassano, culture and media editor for Critical Sociology. Critical Sociology is a quarterly journal published by Sage. For more information, please visit our website, crs.sagepub.com.